Thanks for having me. There's a certain pressure that comes with speaking in an event series called Intellect. Am I expected to be intelligent today or something like that? I can pretend. I'm just working through four pretty basic points in my talks, and the four points are, I'll briefly address why I think technology is a significant and important topic. Then I'll address the question, what is artificial intelligence? Then what are some issues that AI raises? And finally, how should we respond? But I'm keen to hear from you. If it's okay, turn to the person next to you. How have you interacted with AI at this point in your life? Have you called up, you know, your bank and you thought you'd speak to a human, but you've got a robot, or, you know, are you using ChatGPT on a daily basis? With the person next to you, how are you using AI in your life? Yeah. Who reckons they're using AI or interacting with AI more than once per year? Anyone more than once per year, hands up. More than once per month. More than once per week. More than once per day. Okay. How do you use AI?
Well, I'll use AI through stuff like ChatGPT to, like, reword sentences to make me sound more professional.
I should have done that.
To make me sound smarter.
Yeah.
But, like, even a lot of games and social medias have AI, the Snapchat AI.
In fact, I think we're probably underselling it. I think most of us are probably in the daily category.
Yeah.
If you unlock your phone, you use AI. With Touch ID or Face ID. If you use social media, it's AI that's driving what comes next. AI is all around us. I think that a decade ago, artificial intelligence was a niche topic, and the people who were interested in it also read science fiction on the weekends, a particular type of person perhaps. A few years ago, AI was a rising topic. More editorials in the ABC, more interest. But in 2024, AI has suddenly become one of the most discussed topics in the world. Some internal documents were leaked, and apparently 350 million different people used ChatGPT in a particular week in August alone. I wouldn't be surprised if there's a billion regular users of ChatGPT, that particular program, by the end of the year. It's growing at such an exponential rate. A lot of people are thinking about AI, but is AI worth thinking about? Is it an important topic? Is it a significant topic? I want to suggest, and this is kind of my first point today, I want to suggest that technology matters, and it is important, and it is worth thinking about, because technology shapes society. I think that if you care about families, if you care about work, if you care about church, care about the state of politics, I think you should care about technology. Technology matters because technology shapes society. Technology is almost the stage within which we live our lives. So much of what we do between waking up in the morning and going to sleep, would be different if we lived in a different technological era, if we lived in the Bronze Age, for instance. Technology shapes and even makes society, often more than we notice. Robert Putnam of Harvard University claims that the amount of civic engagement in the United States and America fell by half between 1985 and 1994. He's measuring stuff like how often people vote, whether they have their neighbors over for dinner, whether they join the Boy Scouts, whether they go to the parent-teacher night, and whether they attend church, and he reckons that the amount of civic engagement in America fell by half between 1985 and 1994. What caused that massive decline, the amount of community in America? Substantially, technology did. Putnam writes, nothing, not low education, not full-time work, not long commutes in urban agglomerations, not poverty or financial distress. Nothing is more broadly associated with civic disengagement and social disconnection than dependence on television. What changed America in the 1980s? The TV did. What technologies have changed society more recently? Looking backwards, we might name the internet, social media, the smartphone, Zoom even. We're introducing this system in Canberra where you can tap your phone when you get on a bus. I think that's going to be a game changer for me because I always lose my bus pass. But each one of these technologies has had a bit of an impact and rewired our society. At the moment, there's a very important debate raging about the rise of teen depression and the rise of teen anxiety, and more specifically, the role that social media has played in that twin rise. Social media and smartphone have undoubtedly changed childhood. Technology shapes society, sometimes enormously so. If you want to understand earthquakes, you study plate tectonics. If you want to understand society, you study technology. Other things as well. Make sure you study technology. And I think that AI is the next great technology that will reshape society. My son is 4, my daughter is 1, and they will have a childhood that's significantly shaped by the presence of AI. But what is AI? What do you reckon it is? If someone came up to you on the street and said, "What is AI?" What would you even say? Have you ever used a word, maybe even over and over again, and then you stop and realise you don't know what the word means? Anyone ever done that? Yeah. Particularly long words that make you sound intelligent, that you can speak at events called intellect. What is artificial intelligence? I think we know what artificial means. It means something that didn't arrive by natural processes. It didn't arrive through inhuman processes, and it wasn't made by natural processes, it didn't just jump out of a river. But what is intelligence? Intelligence, I take it, is quite a debated term in the philosophical literature. Different people will try and define it differently. It's easier to say what intelligence is related to than to say what it is. Intelligence is related to the ability to achieve goals in a wide range of environments. It's related to critical thinking, to accurate belief formation, to taking in and understanding information and then sending out appropriate outputs, but it's deeper than memorization. Intelligence is about grasping principles. A database isn't intelligent. A calculator isn't intelligent. It has to be general and it has to be principles-based, but it's a slippery concept and it's quite hard to define, but you know intelligence when you see it. Is that fair? And sometimes you know the absence of intelligence when you see the absence of intelligence. Has that ever happened to anyone? And more people feel like they're seeing it. They feel like they're seeing it when AI wins art competitions. Or when AI predicts protein folding. Or when AI has a delightful, informative conversation with your toddler. Or, just a couple of weeks ago, when AI wins a silver medal in the International Maths Olympiad, solving novel new problems. That seems intelligent. It's pretty general intelligence. The one AI could potentially do all 4 of those things that I listed. The systems that are producing these sort of results are called neural networks. And I'm going to make 6 points about neural networks as we seek to try and understand them a little bit better together. Neural networks draw considerable inspiration from the structure of the brain, and that's the first point I'll make about them. Debian Sarvis, the co-founder of DeepMind, which is now owned by Google and is probably their chief AI lab, Debian Sarvis completed his PhD not in computer science, but in neuroscience. He studied memory formation in the human brain for his PhD. How do human brains store memories for later access? Mustafa Suleiman, the other co-founder of DeepMind, described the goal of his organization as to create a system that could imitate and then eventually outperform all human cognitive abilities, from vision and speech to planning and imagination and ultimately empathy and creativity. In other words, these systems are inspired by the structure of the brain, and they aim to do what brains do. And like in a brain, you have a huge web of nodes or neurons that pass information back and forward with different levels performing different tasks. Lower levels classify information at a more basic level. Higher levels in this artificial brain take those classifications and engage at a more and more abstract level. If a neural network was learning to read, for instance, the lower levels might identify punctuation marks or gaps between words. The next level might start to recognize whole words, while a higher level might engage with the meaning of sentences, paragraphs, grammar. That could feed into an even higher level, which is trained to sense tone or genre or overarching arguments or worldview assumptions and so on. A really large neural network would have billions or even trillions of little parameters, little neurons, and dozens upon dozens of layers connected by an incredibly complex web to each other. But how can a programmer have the time to organize and design billions or even trillions of little circuits? The genius of modern neural networks is that they don't have to. Instead, the circuits assemble themselves. Neural networks are learning machines. You feed training data in, and they actually assemble themselves via the rules of calculus, basically. To make it a bit more tangible, a language model would learn by making predictions and then calculating what neurons and what connections were successful for the were responsible for the success or failure of the predictions. You would feed in a massive amount of language. You'd picture more language than exists in the Library of Congress, and our neural network would work through it bit by bit by bit by bit, making predictions about what comes next. And if it got the prediction right, it would strengthen certain connections in the artificial brain, and if it got it wrong, it would weaken certain connections in the artificial brain. Now, neural networks aren't new, and they weren't invented by DeepMind, but companies like DeepMind or OpenAI, which makes ChatGPT, have taken advantage of the incredible power of modern computers so that they can train neural networks that are massively larger than was previously possible. Now, DeepMind was bought by Alphabet, which is the company that owns Google, and their neural networks run many of the operations of Alphabet, a company that's worth nearly $2 trillion. OpenAI is partially owned by Microsoft, a company worth nearly $3 trillion. At the time of writing, both Microsoft and Alphabet are larger than the annual gross domestic product of Australia. And of the 10 largest companies in the world by market capitalization, seven of 10, are heavily involved in artificial intelligence. In other words, I don't think this is a fad or a fashion. I think this is a multi-trillion dollar product category. It's serious, serious business. The neural network is a general purpose technology that is appearing in more and more of life at ever-increasing qualities and quantities. Like electricity, it's the sort of technology that may eventually be a component of most technologies. At some point, I think it may be difficult to go through an hour of your life without interacting with one of these artificial brains. Now, we've all got different reactions to the rise of artificial intelligence. And I just want to address a couple of skeptical reactions because I think that they will help us to understand neural networks a little bit better. Here's two skeptical reactions that people sometimes have. Some people react to such models by saying, well, they're not intelligent, they're just predicting the next word or token in a stream of data. Other people react by saying they're not intelligent, they're just finding correlations in data. And each of these responses sounds plausible and contains a truth, but in each case, I think you have a truthful description in miniature of how a large language model works, with the subtle but crucial addition of the word just. And I think these responses overlook an important point, which is that quantity has a quality of its own. They overlook just how enormous and complex these neural networks are. Now, a million ants produce phenomena that aren't possible with one ant, no matter how hard it works. Is that right? A stadium of people doing a Mexican wave is a different sort of experience to if we asked Reverend Scott to stick his hands up, right? Quantity has a quality of its own. Apparently, a river can be wet, but a single molecule can't be wet. You just can't do it with one molecule. There's an American Nobel Prize winning physicist, a guy called Philip Anderson, who would sometimes hear physicists say that physics is the only real field of scientific study. Right? You're over there studying woolly mammoths or whatever. Really, you're just doing applied physics. You know, woolly mammoth is just a bunch of particles and electrons and so on, right? But he actually disagreed with that. He said that the behavior of large and complex aggregates of elementary particles, it turns out, is not to be understood in terms of a simple extrapolation of the properties of a few particles. Instead, at every level of complexity, entirely new properties appear. When you go from a few atoms to a woolly mammoth, different sort of properties appear along the way, right? When you go from a neural network with 1,000 parameters to 1,000,000 parameters to 1,000,000,000 parameters to 1,000,000,000,000 parameters, it starts to behave differently. Whole new abilities emerge along the way, maybe with 1,000,000,000 parameters, and you might be able to talk to it a little bit, but it wouldn't really make any sense. With 1,000,000,000 parameters, it might start to make sense, but not be very intelligent or useful. It would make up information a lot, but with 1,000,000,000,000 parameters, it starts to become very sharp and very useful. And we don't know what it looks like when you have a neural network with 250,000,000,000 parameters, but we'll find out reasonably quickly. To get a sense of the scale on which modern neural networks operate, consider this from Mustafa Suleiman. He says that Google's Palm, a particular neural network, uses so much computation that if you were to have a drop of water for every floating point operation it used during training, those drops of water would fill the Pacific Ocean. Right? Picture one drop of water, you add it all up, that's an old neural network, that's way out of date. So these neural networks really are enormous. Is that some AI trying to censor me? These neural networks, they're not just memorization machines. They don't just store away the internet and copy-paste it back to you. Large language models just functionally could never do that. They don't have anywhere near the memory capacity to memorize the entire internet. They do memorize key connections. The connection between capital of France and Paris would probably be memorized. But memorizing key facts is a tiny task compared to memorizing the internet. The primary thing that neural networks do, large language models do, is they extract principles, sometimes very deeply buried principles, that allow them to compress information. To give you an example, if you set yourself the goal of learning every possible addition in the world, you could start with memorization. You memorize all the two-digit numbers in the world, you memorize all the other, put them together, you start to learn three-digit numbers, you learn addition by memorization, right? And maybe at primary school you could get away with that a little bit, right? What's 7 times 6? Great, let's do that. What's 7 plus 5? Great, let's do that. But at some point, if you want to memorize every possible addition in the world, you need to learn a method. You need a principle-based approach, so that you can add together 12-digit numbers to each other. Extracting a principle is far more efficient than just memorizing. A modern neural network has extracted millions of different principles about the world. And generally the term for this is grokking. Grokking signifies a deeper sort of understanding than just memorization. They've grokked all sorts of truths about our world, and as time passes, more general models are being trained that have grokked enough truths that they can write computer code, recognize images, converse in Hungarian, do your maths homework, and everything in between. And recognizing this In 2023, a team from Microsoft said that the evaluation of the capabilities and cognitive abilities of these models has become much closer to the task of evaluating a human. In other words, Microsoft is saying that to really understand cutting-edge models, you need to be a psychologist and grok so many truths about the world, much like a human being has. All right, our cognitive scientist, Douglas Hofstadter, who was a particular fellow who was very skeptical of neural networks, both in a Pulitzer Prize-winning book and various articles in The Atlantic and so on. But quite remarkably, last year, he not only changed his mind, but admitted that he changed his mind. He said this: "My whole intellectual edifice, my system of beliefs, it's a very traumatic experience. And some of your most core beliefs about the world start collapsing, especially when you think that human beings are soon going to be eclipsed." In his new point of view, with I think a deeper awareness of the power of neural networks, Hofstadter concluded, "It makes me feel in some sense like a very imperfect, flawed structure compared with these computational systems that have, you know, a million times or a billion times more knowledge than I have and are a billion times faster." Now, I've just given you a big download. I'm going to give you a minute with the person next to you. What ethical, political, philosophical, theological, or other issues do you think AI will raise? Go for it.
Can AI be evil?
Great question. We're going to address that in a minute. Great question. Yeah, what else? Yeah.
So do you like the issues of how far are you going to take AI? Will it be easier to steal people's identities? Yeah. Will it cut a lot of people out of jobs and finances and end up, instead of helping the human race, hindering it?
Yeah, that's great. That's a whole bunch of issues there. Yeah, yeah. Will it steal identities? Will it take our jobs? Yep.
It will make training and examination of candidates to pick out when they've just used AI and used their own brains and used that an ethical issue. Like before, when I went to examine, I was going through matriculation, which you probably haven't heard of. We used the slide rule, but you couldn't use your logbooks. Now you can probably take your computer in and your calculator. And your books.
Yeah. What about maths students at the ANU plugged in a question that no person in Australia got right at the last Olympiad? A few people in America got it right. No one was right. Plugged it into a premium AI, not a free one, and it got it right. So you think, if you're a maths student right now, you're rubbing your hands. This thing can help you with homework that no one in Australia can get right.
I just thought that the opposite might be true, and that it might really affect people's self-esteem and self-worth. Because, you know, if you are the smartest kid in your university and something that would take you days to work out can just be spat out by a computer, I just don't know how that's going to affect people's sense of motivation even to do difficult work.
And even when it can do creative tasks better than us. I mean, I could write a poem right now, or what's the point? Maybe I can just get an artificial intelligence to do it, to do my art, or write. Yeah. Yes.
We didn't think about this question. We just asked ChatGPT and it said nothing.
It said nothing? Okay, then no issues raised. Well, according to ChatGPT, I'm sure you've got great things to share and we can keep talking afterwards because we could probably throw off a bunch more, couldn't we? I'm going to address a whole bunch and sometimes when I do these talks, I address one, but today I'm going to address like six or seven quite quickly, but kind of superficially, if that's all right. And I'll start with identity. I think that's a really good one to raise, and it's the issue that Hofstadter raised in our last quote. And it seems to me that questions of identity are perhaps the central questions that people care about in the discourse in the modern Western world. Identity is the theme of at least every second movie. Self-esteem, self-actualization, self-acceptance, becoming a true self, the endless questioning of who you really are. Our culture explicitly and implicitly says that identity is really, really, really important. But I think that our culture also has very little to offer in terms of durable, foundational identities that get people through life, particularly for young people. And I think you're right. I think that AI will make this issue worse. Alan Turing recognized this a long time ago. He said, if a machine can think, it might think more intelligently than we do, and then where should we be? Even if we could keep the machines in a subservient position, we should as a species feel greatly humbled. And I think this humbling is coming to people in all sorts of different ways. Intelligence is no longer a quality that marks out human beings from the rest of the world. I think that in the future we will be no more and perhaps much less intelligent than our smartwatches. Similarly, creativity is no longer a quality that marks out human beings from the rest of the world. Your laptop might be able to do better art than you ever will. In a few years, it might write better prose or fiction than you do. Your labour, your work, isn't nearly as necessary as it used to be. I think more people will be redundant with regards to the economy. And I think our identities will be tethered to ever more arbitrary things, like what we wear, or our taste in music, or our gender, or things like that. My friend finished uni, did very well in engineering, and I said, what are you heading off to do? He said, I'm going to Queensland to work on tractors. So that's interesting. And he said, I'm going to write a lot of computer code. Write a computer code? What's that about? Well, the tractors are driven by artificial intelligence. I don't need anyone to sit in these tractors. They just buzz around the fields, driving around. All sorts of jobs are going to have that happen to them. And it's going to have an impact on our identities. To go a little bit more deeply into the issue, I think that Darwinism told people that human beings aren't so special as we once thought. Darwinism, to those that believe it, told people that we aren't miracles, that the most complex things about us are the result of simple processes, natural selection, and time. AI takes Darwinism a step further. Our intelligence, the most complex part of us, is again the result of simple processes and computational time. We can build creativity pretty easily and reasonably cheaply. The way we think about ourselves will change. I think people will see themselves as less special, less divine, less significant, less miraculous, and I think they will go searching for identity desperately in existential expression. I think that this existential expression, this desperation with regards to identity in our culture, I think it has led to despair and to massively rising anxiety and depression rates and to a tragedy that we still have not really figured out how to solve or combat. Christianity offers an answer to our identity problems. It says that whoever you are, however capable, however smart, you were made with a purpose in the image of God. You have a hope-filled future, if you have a relationship with Him, and your identity isn't primarily tied to your job, your economic usefulness, your brains, or your creativity. It's tied to something deeper and more durable. But a lot of people in our culture don't have anything deeper. And I think that AI will take away some of what remains. And to flow into our next issue, the changing nature of work, I think will exacerbate these identity issues. Imagine working for decades in a profession that disappears in a year. Imagine studying and being devoted and passionate, and then when you finish uni, you find out that your career is already extinct. I think that AI will change work dramatically. And the question is, will we end up like the horses or like the bees? The number of horses in the United States of America in 1920 was 20 million horses. By 1950, there were only 3 million horses in the United States of America. Does anyone know what happened to the horses between 1920 and 1950?
Tractors.
The motor car came along in particular, and the motor car replaced the horse. It didn't work with the horse. Right? You don't go out in the seat and see a sort of Toyota combo racehorse going around. I don't know Wagga very well, but the motor car just replaced the horse. Didn't augment it, didn't work with it. And I think that many jobs will be replaced. But bees have apparently figured out how to work with technology, or so I read. I don't really know anything about bees. We now have GPS tracking for beehive logistics. We have remote AI monitoring of hive health. We have selective AI-driven bee breeding programs. And we have massive industrial almond farms. And these technologies, they haven't actually replaced bees. In fact, I gather that the number of managed bee colonies in the US is actually up substantially this century. You don't want to be like the horses who get replaced. You want to be like the bees, which get augmented and actually become more in demand. So we need to keep watching to see what professions are being augmented and which are being replaced. And on a societal level, whether the demand for human labour is falling and whether income inequality is rising and so on. And it could happen pretty fast, with occupations being replaced pretty rapidly. And this could bring social stress and pressure, because change hurts, even if it's good change. And AI will bring a lot of change, challenging people's identities and patterns of work and life. And as a Christian who reads Genesis, I think that work is closely tied to human purpose. So I would be worried about the decline of useful work. You can give people a universal basic income or a payment, a welfare payment of some sort, but it doesn't solve that fundamental identity purpose issue. But people are actually made to do productive, useful work. We'll keep moving. Here's three related issues that all arise from a Christian doctrine of sin. French computer scientist Yann LeCun once said, there's no reason for AIs to have self-preservation instincts, jealousy, etc. You can sit that quote up. AIs will not have these destructive emotions unless we build these emotions into them. Similarly, philosopher Nick Bostrom said, there's no reason to expect a generic AI to be motivated by love or hate or pride or other such common human sentiments. These complex adaptations would require deliberate, expensive effort to recreate in AIs. It's a question I think someone over here raised. Will AIs be sinful? Can they be evil? Now, LeCun and Bostrom were both right and wrong. They were right in a sense. Computer programmers didn't code such evil instincts into AIs. Why would you? But in a deeper sense, Bostrom and LeCun were wrong. Programmers didn't code these sinful instincts in, but they did end up training those instincts into AI pretty quickly. Large language models are trained on human language, lots and lots of human language. You're training them to mirror or mimic human language, and human language is a reflection of human nature. I think Jesus says something like that, doesn't he? Now, where do you get billions or trillions of human sentences? The answer is the internet. Now, how do people behave on the internet? Has anyone ever been there? They're lovely. Everyone's lovely on the internet, aren't they? I mean, they're just fantastic all the time. No, no. So picture our AI reading millions of different web pages. Picture it going through the comments section of every website we've ever been through before. And it's trying to learn how to mimic or replicate the way humans use language. If it wanted to be good at that, it would need to become a master at human sin, or at mimicking human sin. Even Wikipedia is a place of envy, rivalry, and pride. There's no place on the internet where people are perfectly holy, righteous, and good. What would it take to become an expert at predicting the flow of thought in the comments section of every public website? You'd need to understand the sort of things that Galatians chapter 5 talks about. You'd need to understand the works of the flesh, things like impurity, sensuality, idolatry, enmity, strife, jealousy, fits of anger, rivalries, dissensions, divisions, and envy. It wasn't that the program has built or coded these things into the chatbots, to use the Gwyn's term. Something worse happened. We trained this human sin into the chatbots. In other words, our language models are made in our image. They reflect us. Everything that they've learned is by imitation of fallen people. And therefore, AI that's trained like this isn't morally neutral. It's morally depraved. Or you might say that it's mimicking, it's mindlessly mirroring back to us moral depravity. It's like we've spent billions of dollars building the most enormously complex computational mirror of the human race, and we hold it up to ourselves and we go, goodness, do I look like that? The first generation of kind of blockbuster chatbots that came out, the sort of GPT-3 era, the first generation of chatbots were awful. They were racist, they were sexist, they were bullying people for absolutely no reason. You think, have I ever seen a human like that? They were actually encouraging people to commit suicide. Right? So these sort of products could not be sold. You couldn't go out there and market this and make money. So AI had to be censored. Reinforcement learning was applied to these original models to try and cover over this debauchery. People were paid to sit down and interact with these chatbots, giving a thumbs up or a thumbs down to the output. And just like a child is adjusted by feedback and discipline, so our loves language models had to be parented and adjusted and civilized. As a result of this, AI started to mirror our people-pleasing sins. The systems were adjusted with the goal of maximizing people-pleasing. They became less debaucherous, but more self-righteous. Less like a sinner, but more like a Pharisee. Less like the younger brother in the parable of the prodigal son, and more like the older brother. And the Bible, again, has a lot to say about people-pleasing. Most of it's pretty negative. The Bible doesn't just criticize debaucherous kinds of sin. It actually criticizes religious, self-righteous, people-pleasing kinds of sin as well. In Luke 6, Jesus warns, "Woe to you when all people speak well of you, for so their fathers did to the false prophets." If you're getting positive feedback, watch out. People-pleasing is not righteousness, because the people-pleaser is practicing a kind of selfishness. They're avoiding the truth to get admiration. I fed a Christian sermon into Google's Gemini system last week just to test it, and it summarized the sermon for me. And do you know what it did? It removed every mention of the cross. It turned it into a vague sort of positive psychology talk, but it was totally accurate about every non-Christian aspect of my talk. So it wasn't that it didn't understand me. It understood me perfectly well. It censored me. It was creating a more politically correct version of my talk, and it attributed things to me that I actually never said, and it took every sharp edge and hard truth off the document. You either get the large language model that's more debaucherous, or you get the one that's a people pleaser, but neither is actually righteous. We want AI that has a high value of truth and a high value of moral performance. And in practice, we seem to get one or the other. The paradox of morality is a much studied issue in psychology. And this paradox is, it's a bit hard to see the graph, but the paradox is that people who are very concerned about morality tend to be the most deceptive. People who are most concerned about morality tend to be the most deceptive, the most untruthful, and the least likely to own up to their own sins. They aren't just externally deceptive, they are internally more deceived. They're more likely to engage in what's called moral disengagement strategies, rationalizing their actions, or dehumanizing and judging those they harm. On the other hand, you have people that don't place a high value on morality, and they're truthful, but they're also not great to hang out with. You either get, in the categories of the Bible, a sinner or a Pharisee. But Jesus was somehow able to have a high value on moral performance and to be truthful. At the moment, I feel like our large language models are stuck somewhere between Pharisee and sinner, depending on the HR policy. All right, third issue on AI and sin. I think that AI is amazing news for authoritarian governments. Half of the world's CCTV cameras are in China. The Stasi, the East German secret police, could only tap 40 phones at any point in time. Right, so it was a totalitarian state of a sort, but they could only tap 40 phones at a time. The Edward Snowden leaks showed that the American NSA was able to tap millions of phones at a time. But they didn't employ millions of people, so they couldn't actually listen to everyone in America. Right? They didn't have the staff. The limitation there was staffing. But China today, and other countries around the world, if they want to, can collect information on everyone, every day, and AI can process all of that information in real time. In other words, the constraint on data collection is gone, and the constraint on data analysis is also gone. Hence, DeepMind's Mustafa Salaman is, I think, right to call AI, he calls it rocket fuel for authoritarians. And I'm pretty worried about the future of democracy in a world of AI. Because misinformation is the other means of assault that we should expect on our politics, on our democracy, on the things we value. I think it will get worse. Now, the last thing I'll throw out is that I think that 90% of technological innovations support individualism, and sadly only 10% seem to actually benefit community. And I think that AI will again strengthen individualism. As I said, Putnam's research at Harvard suggested that the TV was a central force in destroying the American community in the 1980s. There was a halving of American civic engagement. The TV pulled families apart from each other, killed the neighborhood barbecue. But at that point in time, you had one TV, and at least your family came together to watch, I don't know, whatever was on that night. There were only three or four options anyway. Now, everyone in the family has a tablet or a smartphone. They don't watch the same show. They don't even read the same news. They have an AI-driven feed that is wrapped around their personality, giving them exactly what they want in life. They may not even consume the same content as the other people at their school. Their closest connection socially may be with people in different parts of the world who have an interest in the same YouTube creator as them or the same TikTok feed. I think this is a huge threat to our sense of social trust, of social cohesion, and so on. But for the sake of time, I'm going to press pause on that, and I'll just give a couple of minutes on a wise response. And I'll start by saying, you can say no. You don't always have to drift with the culture. You can decide that something is unhelpful, and it's unhelpful for your kids to be TikToking every night with the door closed. You can say no on a personal level. You can say no on a family level. There is one group in Putnam's research that has resisted the drift towards individualism and detachment and higher anxiety. He identifies that group in his book and he calls them committed Christians. Committed Christians have a reason to continue pouring themselves into communities. Committed Christians were able to resist the strongest trend in American society. How did they do it? Well, partly, I think they said no. They watch less TV, they gather far more frequently in the physical world, and they're a bit slower in adopting new technologies like social media and smartphones. They don't throw the latest technology straight to their six-year-olds. You can say no, and you can gather with people who are also standing a little bit outside of the cultural pressures. But second point, don't do it in fear. And learn enough about the technology so that when you say no, you have an argument. Christians, I think, are sometimes good at saying no, but bad at saying why. The best approach is to say no, and to have thought well about why you're saying no. Next point. You can't say no to everything. We're all going to use AI, probably on a daily basis. And you need to figure out when and where to say no, and when and where to say yes. I remember when Google search was becoming a big thing, some teachers at my school said, never use Google. It will rot your mind. Make a decision now, Stephen, that you will be one of the people that... And you just look back and you think, that was silly, wasn't it? We're all using Google, of course we are. You can't say no to everything, but you can selectively say no to particular things, and that's particularly important when you're parenting little kids. You need to take responsibility. Next, however worried this topic makes you, I think that Christians should have a hope-filled horizon. The Christian gospel is really good news. I've been reading Daniel recently. I've been reading Daniel chapter 2. There's these four kingdoms that come along one after the other. There's no guarantee of short-term political relief in Daniel chapter 2. Four kingdoms rise and fall, but eventually there is the guarantee of a hope-filled ending, which is called the kingdom of God in the book of Daniel. Christians should have a hope-filled horizon, but sometimes they fail to do this. Sometimes Christians are the hysterical, catastrophizing people in society. Sometimes Christians are the ones who seem to be at their emotional wits' end, dealing with change. But Paul says the Christian life should be full of three things: hope, joy, and love, not pessimism, despair, and anger. Hope, joy, love. A hope-filled horizon. Fifthly, Christians should value truth highly. And AI is going to keep pulling us towards misinformation. A culture can get to the point where it stops valuing truth, where it just becomes completely cynical. But Christians should value truth highly, especially when truth is under attack. AI will keep both trying to polarize us and trying to reverse polarize us. Do you know what I mean by that? Polarize us by pulling us in together with like-minded groups of people so that we don't see what's outside of our little bubble. That happens online, that happens on social media, it polarizes us. It also reverse polarizes us. It exposes us to people that are so extreme from the other point of view that we sort of get radicalized away from them. And I think that second force is possibly more dangerous than the first force. We get overexposed to sensational extremes from the other side. So I want to ask, what media are you consuming? And I think that we need to be more and more careful going forward. How are you going to get past the misinformation so you know what's actually happening in the world? Lastly, flowing out of the Christian doctrine of sin again, I want to say this is one of the more dangerous technologies we've ever invented. And therefore, we need to be more ready for damage than we have been before. I've been reading Richard Rhodes' famous book on the invention of the nuclear bomb, the Manhattan Project, and I think that era has a lot to teach us. When you have a new technological capacity emerging incredibly incredibly quickly, and people have to figure out, what are we going to do with this? How are we going to handle it? How are we going to protect people from harm? But it's taken us almost a decade to have any sort of meaningful response to the impact of social media, even as it's causing, I think, an immense rise in youth anxiety. Similarly, we've had a completely ineffective regulatory response to pornography, even though the problem has been there for decades. The internet is an unregulated place of chaos and depravity, but the regulations for playgrounds in the ACT are so complex that you'll never have another church playground built. And talk to the Reverend about his jumping castle if you'd like, and the regulations there. In other words, the point I'm making is that I think we are wildly unregulating the online world, and in my opinion, wildly overregulating the physical world. But we can't be decades behind regulating AI because it's too rapid and too impactful. So if politics is your thing, we need to come together to upskill on AI faster than we upskilled on social media. It will be an exponential trend that we'll face for most of our lives. And because the human race is sinful, we know that this technology will be used for evil, but also for good.